So the title of the talk tonight is Forgiveness and Cleaning the Past. And in the 1980s, when I was really involved in alternative medicine in England, I was kind of pioneer of the alternative medicine movement in England. And there was a woman called Penny Bronn that opened a cancer centre which became very famous. It was called the Bristol Cancer Help Centre. And they weren't allowed to use the word cancer treatment centre so by the government, so they called it Cancer Help Centre. And I met her and I asked her, what kind of conditions are created what kind of conditions are created in your center that actually make a major difference to people with cancer? That means they go into remission, they are treated or really helped, their cancer is really helped by alternative medicine. What kind of things? What really makes a difference? And she said, what really makes a difference is the groups. And I was surprised. I thought she would say herbs, acupuncture. No, the groups. And so I said, what is it in the groups that makes a difference? And she said, forgiveness. We work with the groups until there is a real deep forgiveness. Because at that moment, the people rediscover the deep will to live. And they need to go through forgiveness in order to uncover the deep will to live. And the deep will to live does the job. The herbs and so on are extra. Acupuncture, all extra. The will to live does the job. So I was very impressed with that. And I think that forgiveness is about cleaning the past, which is a burden which we hold on our shoulders, and in our unconscious, subconscious mind, and weighs us down. And it's very hard for us to start fresh, to really get out from under the burden, from under the weight, and start fresh, because we don't know where the weight is. We kind of can't locate where it is that's holding us down. Forgiveness begins to take off the load. And we find slowly, slowly that we feel less prisoned by the past, less held by the past, less closed in by habits and the past repeating itself all the time in us. And if we want to begin fresh, if we want to begin fresh, we can't really begin except from a place of freedom. We can try to begin fresh, but we keep finding ourselves held by old wounds, old scars, salakot, old hurts. And it can make us feel crippled, that we're just not free, we're limping, carrying this stuff, old hurts that keep going round and round and round. And in the social world, it's huge. It becomes, these hurts become iconic, like icon means, you know, holy, like the Shoah is held by the society as an icon, which is suppressing and suppressing, imprisoning the whole society in a way, because of its iconic status. It's hard to get out from under it. Renew life, freedom, real freedom, release from anxiety, release from pressure. But we do it to ourselves. We make an icon out of our hurts, and then we kind of get comfortable with the victim mode, a victim narrative, and we just, that's the way life is. Life is shit. We, you know, what to do. This favorite, when you go to England and you ask people how they are, they never say I'm fine, I'm great. They would say something like, mustn't grumble. You know that one. Not only I want to grumble, but I'm not allowed to grumble because it's not polite to grumble, so, but I actually want to grumble. Asuli litlonen, kid. Here in Israel, they just mitlonen as much as they can. There's not enough people though to hear, because everyone is trying to mitlonen everybody else, so there's no one listening anymore. And we we're a little bit suspicious of forgiveness sometimes, because it feels like a trick, and it can be, and we do really have to watch this. This is a classic escape, which is calling forgiveness a kind of slogan and saying we all must do forgiveness, and then we feel fine, and actually nothing much has changed, because the forgiveness doesn't go deep. There is quite a big thing in Christianity about forgiveness, but often it's just words. And if you think of the Bible, the prophets and the Nevi'im, how every prophet actually was complaining about the priesthood, the tendency to give a sacrifice. So because you want forgiveness, so you give a sacrifice in the temple, and then you feel good and you go home, and nothing has changed. You haven't actually repaired anything. You haven't given to the poor, you haven't given to no tikkun really happened. So the prophets, the Nevi'im, that was their big story, showing that forgiveness as just a kind of social habit doesn't really do anything. It has to be combined with action, it has to be combined with a real, genuine, deep change, with action, with repair. Think of Yom Kippur and all the tradition in Yom Kippur, which actually, when you look at Yom Kippur, I also look at it a bit like the Nevi'im, because to me the day after Yom Kippur is pretty well the same as the day before. People go out their life, they're fighting with each other, they keep, you know, it looks pretty well the same as the day before Yom Kippur. Nothing really dramatically changed because of all the prayers. It needs something deeper than that, and in the sources, by the way, they really talk about this. But it does raise the question, and it is an interesting question, how we are to act, to repair, to give, to do something different, to go out into the world and yes, to help and fix things. And it turns out that forgiveness deeply is one of the best ways to do this, because you can't act if you're still burdened by all the old stuff. If you're a victim, you don't act. You've got the old stuff, it paralyzes you. I remember on one of our visits, workshops with Palestinians in Nablus, Shechem, and they were always very interesting and very dynamic. And at one time, some of the Israeli Jews that were there in dialogue with the Palestinians were talking about their guilt, that they feel the guilt of being occupying power and making endless suffering for the people who are occupied. And the Palestinians said, we don't want your guilt because it paralyzes you. We want free people, Israelis, who can do something different and who do not go with the consensus. And if you feel guilty, all you do is you stay at home, you turn on the television, and you stay inside the consensus. You become part of the silent majority who cannot act. So we don't want your guilt. It was very wise for the Palestinians to react like that. And we all were quite impressed with this insight. The guilt is not a good basis for action. When you think of modern South Africa, how there was such a dialogue in the international world about the Truth Commission. What's the point of it? And you realize the society is healthy because of the Truth Commission. It instead of punishment, revenge, and so on, there was a sense of release, of forgiveness. It was more than just a symbol. It was releasing power, and the power of the society to heal itself depended on the wisdom of the Truth Commission. It didn't bring back the dead that were killed, but it cleaned the past. So in a sense, when we practice forgiveness, when we do it seriously, we are actually taking responsibility. It's not any, if we do it seriously, it's not just words like the Nevi'im said, sacrifices, or it's not words, it's taking responsibility by cleaning what is imprisoning us, what is paralyzing us, and giving us the power, empowerment to do something about it. That's real forgiveness. And actually, as I said, in the Jewish sources, that's the way Yom Kippur should be actually practiced. You look in the Talmud, it says every word on forgiveness has to be combined with action. The two go together. Forgiveness and action are intimately connected with wisdom. On a deeper level, the act of forgiveness can in a way change fate. It can change karma. It can shift something in ways which we don't know. We don't really know it. We don't know how it happens, but forgiveness is a power that shakes something in the karma. When I use the word karma, I mean all the vast influences and conditions that are needed to create this moment right now. All the huge, vast, uncountable influences in the world that make this moment now. In other words, it needs the whole world to be as it is for this moment to be as it is. That's karma. But we can look at it also in the human level as the qualities which we express, which we have received, which we work with, which then tend to go out into life, make change based on those same qualities. The qualities in us are the seeds that we sow, and they also boomerang. So we tend to have the qualities which we give out into life tend to be the qualities which we bring back into life. The quality of love which we give into life will tend to make life for us more loving. We will receive love, give love. We would tend to flow in the direction of love. Qualities of anger which we give out into life will tend to make our life full of anger, boomerang this, sowing the seeds and reaping the fruit. Tends to be. It's not an absolute rule. It's just a tendency, kind of movement there. I love the story of Yonah, which we work on every Yom Kippur retreat. We work on the story of Yonah, and I love it partly because that's my Hebrew name, Yonah. But it's a really amazing story, and one of the is many, many, many issues in that story which are relevant to forgiveness. But one of the issues is that Yonah is a prophet, but a bit of a lost case in a way. He's very human. He is not this kind of high ultimate figure, untouchable. He runs away from his commitment and his responsibility, and he gets forgiven. God comes and kind of rescues him. He gets him depressed and he can't bear the conflict he's in, and he goes right down and gets deep depression, gets thrown off the boat, and again he gets rescued. He goes into I would call it deep meditation inside the Leviathan there. I mean, right into the dark space there with the elements, with the earth, and he talks about being kind of closed in by the bars, the imprisoned. His feeling of being imprisoned in there, but he's in the dark space, imprisoned, despaired, and he comes through it. And I would say it's like very much like his retreat in the belly of the whale. I mean, alavai, we can go through what he went through in this retreat here, or any retreat. It's like a shamanistic journey to death and to rebirth. And then he went to Nineveh, and he was amazed, but the whole city was forgiven. In all of these cases, forgiveness happened by God, by divine. And it reminds us of the Brahma Viharas. There's something divine here. It wasn't he that could forgive. God forgived. He was an agent. All the time it was God doing the forgiving. He helped that process. He was allowed it. He was an agent in there. But in the end, it was forgiveness was in the karma, in the fate, in the God world, in the divine world. And he was actually, in some cases, not ready for that, and objecting to it, and arguing about it. And the bigness of things created forgiveness. There is a very strong story in the suttas, the Angulimala Sutta. Many of you would know it. There was a kind of evil guru that told his student he has to go into the forest and kill 1,000 people. And Angulimala did. He went into the forest and he killed many, many, many people, and nobody could do anything against him. And he killed 999 people. And Angulimala is the chain, mala is a chain, necklace of fingers. He wore them around his neck as fingers, 999 fingers. And the Buddha came nearby and said, "This guy's really suffering, I have to do something for him." And all his monks said, no, "He mustn't, he'll kill you. He kills everybody. He's too strong, he will." The Buddha said, "Don't worry." And he insisted. So he went in alone to the forest, and Angulimala turned up. And the Buddha walked. And Angulimala said, "Stop, stop." And the Buddha walked, didn't stop. And Angulimala was trying to chase him and said, "Stop, stop." And he couldn't catch him. And the Buddha was just walking, quietly. And then the Buddha turned to him and said, "You stop. I stopped a long time ago." Beautiful phrase. "You stop. I stopped already a long time ago." In other words, stop your anger, rage, burning, killing. Just stop. So at that point, they talked, and the Buddha gave Dharma, and Angulimala became one of the disciples of the Buddha. And then there's a very strange part of this story, that one day he was already a monk, and quite a kind of awakened monk, Angulimala, and he heard there was a woman who was struggling with childbirth, and she was possibly going to die. And he went to the Buddha and said, "What shall I do? I really want to help this woman, but I don't know what to do." And the Buddha said to him, "Go to the woman and say, 'Since I was born, I never killed anybody.'" Angulimala said, "What? You want me to tell such a lie? I can't lie. It's the wrong speech." The Buddha said, "So okay, say, 'Since I was reborn as a monk, I didn't kill anybody.'" And he went there to the woman and he said this to her, and she passed through her childbirth, okay. And I understand that rather enigmatic story to mean the karma can be changed in a really dramatic way. And he was telling the woman, "Look how karma changed in me. Look what happened to me. How everything can radically change, and it can change in you too." In other words, it's kind of giving a message that we're not locked in a kind of a track that leads us to this or that or this. The whole thing is dynamic. Karma is dynamic. Our fate is dynamic. We can change everything, and it's the same message of forgiveness. Forgiveness can change everything. The city of Nineveh can be saved. 100,000 people can be saved by the act, the right time, the right moment. You can change anything. The world is dynamic. We don't have to feel locked into our fate, or locked into, I'm going to be always like this. It's a very, narrative that we give ourselves. Oh, I'm always going to be like that. Actually, every time we're sick, we think, "Oh, my whole life, now I'm going to be like this, rest of my life I'm going to be..." We have a tendency to do that, but the Angulimala story shows us that Angulimala, in saying this, shows the radical restart that we can do with our life, re-beginning, renewing, start again, move off in another direction. If we have that model of ourselves, it works. If we have a model that everything is frozen, that works too. We have to choose to the dynamic model, and forgiveness will help us in this. An absolutely free person doesn't need to do any practice on forgiveness. Doesn't need. Because nothing sticks. Such a person can't be wounded. In an anatta, or a not-self, world of no self, there's no self to be wounded. There's no self to hold on to hurt. But you and me, let's call ourselves ordinary human beings, and we do need to practice forgiveness. The Buddha said, "He struck me, he robbed me, he abused me." Holding on to this creates more violence, more hatred. You have to let these things go. This does need practice. This does need some skill. And that's why we practice here, and we have been practicing today. And the practice will start with some calmness. It isn't quite difficult to practice forgiveness and to really go into this in the craziness of ordinary life. Quite difficult. We can, of course, forgive people. and especially when we see how good it is to forgive and how much joy comes from forgiving them, but in daily life. But it's to really do sort of the cleaning, it does need quiet. It's helpful to be where we are on retreat, where we spend really quite a long time with it. It needs intention, and it's not so easy. And it needs repetition. And that's why the phrases really help us. And the places where we really can work is actually where it's difficult for us. We think, well, I can forgive John, Fred, Jim, but not Robert, not Shmulik, not this one, not her. This not, it's too much. I can't forgive that. I cannot. I have too much baggage, because there's too much of a tick there. I cannot. That's actually the place to be. When, like I said yesterday or day before yesterday, when we know our limits, that's where to work. That's the place to work, because this practice, whether it's love or forgiveness, works. We practice against resistance. When we see the resistance, that's where the place to push, to look. Okay, it's hard for me, I'll go there again. Okay, I'll go for a walk on the trees, I feel the blessing of the grass underneath my feet. Now I'll go back and forgive this person that I really can't forgive. Okay, I'll try it again. So it's kind of working on the edge is where it works. We push the limit. And again, I want to say something that as just a general point, all of you, I guess, have been on retreats before, and the Brahmaviharas retreat is different. And the beginning of the retreat, I think some of you felt it's awkward to deal with phrases and to deal with content, because in the Vipassana world we're actually not really dealing with content, tochen. We're just letting it go, and here we're actually not letting it go, we're actually repeating it, we're actually inviting content. So it has taken some of you a little while, quite understandably, to realize that we're working here with content. We are purifying content, tochen, instead of letting it go. But it's really important to realize that we have content all the time. And so what we're actually doing is purifying the narratives, ha narrativim, ha, we're purifying the narratives that we have anyway. In any way they're narrative. So we're just simply changing the narrative. And this is a classic in the Dharma. The Dharma is not only about just mindfully seeing things as they come and seeing the things as they go. It is also changing the narratives. All through the text and all through the teachings, there is a teaching of, I don't know the Pali word, Karen isn't here, but is what is wholesome. Sava, is it? Asava and Sava? I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, the word wholesome in English means healthy or feeding us. Nutrition. What feeds our inner life? What feeds us? We go there. And so it's not only about just seeing content and letting it go, which is really, really important, which is hugely important for our spiritual life. But at the same time, it's changing the content, replacing content which is scattered, confused, or toxic, or busy with the scars and the wounds, instead of with freedom, changing those narratives, changing the narratives that obsess us or hold us. It's shifting the stream of consciousness. And in some way, of course, they're very, very similar things about working with content and working with no content, that the heart and the mind are always together. There isn't one moment of perception or awareness or meeting with the world that doesn't have heart in it. The heart is what empowers the mind to look, to see, to know, to pay attention, to direct. Because we're not computers. The heart is empowering the mind all the time. So, just like in a mindfulness practice, we notice that the mind is jumping everywhere, chaotic, not really helping us, full of mess, full of confusion, and then we gradually tie it down, we gradually direct it, and the monkey mind becomes the elephant. And that's in the traditional image. The monkey mind becomes the elephant that actually can really do work for us, can really serve us and can serve others. And in a way, working with the heart, the monkey heart also becomes the elephant heart. Becomes steady. Our heart also needs attention. Our heart is also full of chaos, confusion, like I said, wounds, jumping around. And here is practice that actually aligns the heart in a positive direction for us. So it goes so well with mindfulness practice that aligns the mind, that directs the mind. So here we direct the heart. And it goes really well. It's in some way a parallel practice. And both of them pulling us, the aligned heart and the aligned mind, the directed heart, the directed mind, are pulling us or pushing us towards joy and freedom. Thank you. So let's take a few minutes.